Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2000. This is the next to the last event in our Words in the World series. It concludes with Russell Banks in early June, and it's been a wonderful series. We'd like to thank our funders, the National Endowment for the Humanities, Amgen, and the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. When I was 16, a friend handed me a poem with the provocative title, The Immoral Proposition. It was written by someone named Robert Creeley. Who was he, I wondered? An Elizabethan poet? It went, "If you never do anything for anyone else, you are spared the tragedy of human relationships. If quietly and like another time, there is the passage of an unexpected thing. To look at it is more than it was. God knows nothing is competent, nothing is all there is. The unsure egoist is not good for himself." The poem entranced me, puzzled me, spoke to me in a voice older, world wiser. I carried it around like a talisman for many years. Later, I found my way to the poet's work. By God, he was of my time. He was alive. To his collection, For Love, many poems of which insinuated themselves into my memory. For love, I would split open your head and put a candle in between the eyes. God is dead. Love is dead in us if we forget the virtues of an amulet and quick surprise. I love the bravado, the implied vulnerability, the struggle for self-knowledge, the acknowledgement of the fragility and worth of human relationships. It is for good reason that the poet Robert Duncan, a good friend and colleague of Creeley's, called his work both visionary and oracular. Oracular meaning a pleading, a prayer, a sense of danger, prophetic. As a young woman, I read the work of this then middle-aged male poet as a guide, a touchstone. I even confess I wrote my literature thesis on Robert Creeley at Reed College, though I would be horrified if anyone were to find it and read it now. What did I know then? I was fascinated then, as now, at the poet's unflinching honesty, at how his poems enacted emotional conflicts that flare in moments of conscious awareness, how his poems suggested that truths are ongoing, mutable, subject to endless revisions, and on his insistence that wonder was the place to be. As the poet Charles Olson said, "So is it not the play of a mind we are after? Is not that that shows whether a mind is there at all?" In Robert Creeley's poetry, mind is there, the playful work of the mind. Now, reading Creeley as a middle-aged woman and writer, I'm still deeply moved by that now older, still more worldly wise poet. In his most recent volume, Life and Death, the same poet noted for his tense, edgy portrayals of anxiety and distance in relationships, explores the universal realities of aging and mortality and the fundamental human need to connect. In his remarkable long poem, Histoire de Florida, Creeley employs the poetic equivalent of a cinematic zoom into internal consciousness, outward to the backdrop of various condominiums and cottages, a dissolve to a near-death experience in a hotel in Calcutta, 1944, a long shot of the land itself, quote, "the pendant form of it, the way it goes out, alone, into an ocean." It's a panoramic view above the sea's surface where there's, quote, "nothing that isn't vulnerable." By good fortune, I discovered over the internet, where else, a recent Creeley publication called Daybook of a Virtual Poet. This volume consists of transcripts from his online conversations with City Honors High School students in New York. An elder, Creeley can be as youthful as the electronic text in which he corresponds. What lucky students to hear Robert Creeley roam so lucidly over topics as various as Hart Crane, Raising Pygmy Pigeons, The Death of James Dickey, to be introduced to great poems by Emily Dickinson, Wordsworth, to read about poets so rarely anthologized like Muriel Rukeyser and George Oppen, to read Creeley's tender elegy for Allen Ginsberg, and most of all, to hear him emphasize so definitely William Carlos Williams' point about the act of writing. Quote, "Why don't we tell them it's fun?" And then Creeley says, not just the authority of endless revisions, not just the lists of publications or prizes won, not just the company of poets of public record, just fun, fun, fun. When Creeley received the Bullingen Prize in Poetry in 1999, one of his many honors, the poet Bob Holman wrote, "Let us pause to praise and then let us party. At a time when poetry is sparking fires all over, the tender ember that's Creeley's is what's kept the invention of poetry alive." In his autobiography, Creeley relates how at the ceremony where he was appointed state poet of New York, then-Governor Mario Cuomo commented, "With courage and cunning, he has made the discreet loneliness of the solitary individual into a universal experience." Creeley then wryly remarks, "People must love me for that." And they do. Please welcome Robert Creeley.
I was really charmed by Mario Cuomo's lovely statement. The word was that he wrote those all himself, but the discreet loneliness of the individual, I've made it into a universal experience. Like, thanks a lot. I'll try now to do something better, or at least more useful. I think we came of age, dear persons of my generation, in that confusion of the Second World War, that awful time, and that sense of you have nothing to fear but fear itself, or we all were reading Kafka and Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground, and we read Gide, but we of course went into Sartre and the whole imagination, and then on and on, Camus, the sense of the, we realized that humanness, human beings on the face of the earth were the most destructive element, and there seemed little hope of changing things. Previous to that century, now over, had been the first in which human disaster had outpaced natural disaster. But I suppose human disaster is also natural in its own way. But you couldn't really... in a poem of Williams's, Tribute to the Painters, which is what, from Patterson, Book 5, he speaks of the doctor and the consoling his fellows in the trench, as he says, as the SS officer indifferently sprays them with machine gun bullets. I mean, there is that. You don't have to give up being human just because you live adjacent to a creek that has over 200 identified, toxic elements. So what if it's in back of the church in the school? You know, you can even fish in it. I don't want to be simply bleak, but I would want to begin with recent poems. Very recent, the last week or so. One, for example, I'm trying to write something that is appropriate for Buffalo. The University of Buffalo has an annual celebration of the Phi Beta Kappa. And that's always been a tacitly intimidating group to my imagination. But I did think of I thought of Williams, and I think it's 1951, his extraordinary poem that he writes, The Desert Music, for the celebration at Harvard. And then back of that, roughly a little more than a century, is Emerson's The American Scholar, et cetera, et cetera. But somehow, I certainly had no ambitions to write such decisive texts of either sort. But I was trying to think of something appropriate. This is part of this is the conclusion of a longer address for the Phi Beta Kappa ceremony. It wasn't only me, this condition, but rather the way a world was there, each thing seeming precedent, like a ledge to climb out on. So I thought and felt the world could be everywhere, even inside myself, just so my body carried me, but shifted, acted as it would. There was no law but physical event. There was no mind without a defining occasion, else no tree, no forest ever, no game today or tomorrow. Think of it, a moment in mind, a breeze perhaps, the curtains pushed by the air as it moves always in such complex passage. A brilliant mathematician, a woman, in a documentary once about the evils of Auschwitz, told how, isolated in her cell, she had first unraveled, then rewoven the edges of her clothing over and over. So she survived. Her clarity, even her humor, had come through. It may be the same road we all take or will. All we think to know, we have to learn. Then, also quite recently, or very recently, as a continuing happy relation with painters, artists, I had chance to work with a charming small print woodblock that Alice Katz had done, which figures or shows almost at first almost with, almost like a haze. What one recognizes are the hulls and masts of three small skiffs, and then adjacent what seemed three skiffs without the masts, and it's all sort of mid image, and above and below the texture is so curiously undifferentiated. It's almost the same seeming substance. It's very much like a characteristic early morning in Maine as you look out to the water and see that curious mist that thus makes those elements conjoin. So I wrote a poem called Thinking. Thought feels the edges. Just so far it was only yesterday. So far it seems now till tomorrow. Time isn't space. Away for the day, one says, gone fishing, now and again. The sounds echo in the quiet morning. Such faint edges of place, things, not yet quite seen. But one knows the familiar presences. The world will be as one left it, still there, to reappear again, perhaps, where it always is. Then, moving back a bit, this is a poem from time in Maine last summer, a pleasant friend, Anya Levin, who's been a graduate student at Buffalo, University of Buffalo, until just recently. She's got a charming appointment to go teach at Dartington Arts Institute in England. And she had written to ask what if I'd ever had any, not concerns, I guess problems would be the best word, with the sense of the outside. And I thought, God, have I ever had problems with the, quote, outside? It's anyhow, for Anya, an outside was always what I wanted to get to, the proverbial opening in the clearing, plain church with massed, seated persons, the bright water dense with white caps and happy children. Was I late, stupid, to arrive always as it's me, somehow still alone, however I'd thought myself present, muted the persistent self-concerns, took requisite chances, trying to let go? Evening's clouds seem a dynasty, an end forever to such confusion. Birds sing still at the edges of hearing. Night settles itself comfortably, far, and once and for all, beyond me. I think, and therefore I am self-conscious. There are no mirrors here to look into, no answering reassurances once sufficient. The outside is empty but vast, I think. It's everywhere around me. And still there. Then one last from this time. Again, last summer I had a charming chance to write a poem apropos a show of 10 years' work that the painter Susan Rothenberg was to have in Boston. So for several reasons, I was attracted that it was to be in Boston. I'd worked with this artist previously in a sequence called Parts. And these 19 paintings were specific to her 10 years in New Mexico, where I'd also lived in real sense for quite some time. So, and also she's from Buffalo, New York, which is attractive to me. So they sent me, also the curator of the show was from Buffalo, New York. Or had been working there until recently and was now at the Museum of Fine Arts. So I was sent the images that were to be in the show, and it was such a circumstance that one couldn't give each a singular address, so there had to be somehow a means of locating them, at least in some response, as a feeling or proposal or content particular that seemed consistent. And so here's that poem. Possibilities. What do you wear? How does it feel to wear clothes? What shows what you wear or wear? This accidental person, feeling out, feelings out, outside the box one's in, skin's resonances, reticent romances, the blotch of recognition, blush. It's a place one's going out to, could reach out just so far to be at the edge. Of it all, there, no longer inside, waiting, expectant, a confused thing. One wanted skin to walk in, be in. One wanted each leg to stand, both hands to have substance, both eyes to look out, recognize all of it, closer and closer. Put it somewhere, one says, put it down. But it's not a thing, simply, it's all of it here. All of it near and dear, everywhere one is, this and that. Inside, it could have been included. There was room for the world. One could think of it, even be simple, ample. But not multitudes, not that way in. It's out one's going, loosed. Still, wistful in heaven, happy in hell. Sky was an adamant wall, earth a compact of dirty places. Faces of people one used to know, air, smell, sound, and taste, was still wonderful. One dreamed of a thoughtless moment, the street rushing forward, heads up. One willed almost a wave of silence to hear the voices underneath. Each layer, each particular, recalled. But now to be here, putting my hand on the table, I watched it turn into wood, fibrous, veins like wood's grain. But not that way separated, all one. I felt a peace come back, no longer needed to say what it was, nothing left somehow to name only, still was each, all, evident mass, bulky, some, a complex accumulation. My mother, dying, sat up ecstatic, coming out of the anesthetic, said, it's all free, you don't have to pay for any of it, it's there. If you can still get to it. Come closer, closer. Come as near as you can get. Let me know each edge, each shelf of act, all the myriad colors, all the shimmering presences, each breath, finger of odor, echoed, pin drop. Adumbrate nature. Walk a given path. You are as much its fact as any other. You stand a scale far smaller than a tree's. A mountain makes you literal as a pebble. Look hard for what it is you want to see. The sky seems in its heavens, laced with cloud. The horizon's miles and miles within one's sight. Cooling, earth gathers in for night. Birds quiet, stars start out in the dark. Wind drops, thus life itself can settle. Nothing's apart from all, and seeing is the obvious beginning of an act can only bring one closer to the art. Of being closer, so feeling all there is, one's hands and heart grow full. Thanks. Thank you. I'd sent it first. I had her a classic fax number, so I faxed it to her. The people back at her gallery and also at the museum seemed to be pleased enough. But, it, you know, frankly, the point was did it work for her? So something like two or more days went by and there was no word at all. And I started to get very nervous. And then one afternoon, I was up in Maine by myself. The phone rang and charmingly it was Susan. And I'll never forget her first words were, "How did you know?" And I said, "What do you mean, how did I know?" I said, "Well, how did you know?" I said, "I don't even know you that well. You know, that I'd read the paintings apparently in ways that seemed to satisfy very much, you know, the dirty, the places, the faces and all that stuff." And I said, "Well, you know, I looked at those 19 images that they sent and the, you know, I was, your paintings seemed to say this very explicitly." So that was, that felt good. There's really no other way that argues. It's not an understanding of what she does or what any of this painter, it isn't some sense to try to describe what you see. That's you, why do that? And there's equally no hope in trying to understand and then present. It's like, I love, there's a great line of Philip Whalen's I'll never forget, which is initiating experience of the ocean out there. He says, let's call it the Pacific, which I think is just perfect. What the hell, let's call it, no, but just, well, let's call it the Pacific. Pretty good, Phil, yeah. That's as good as it gets, in fact. And I couldn't explain to you why that's, you know, all that poetry is or ever was, but that's it. I was telling friends about our son, Will, who's just left home this last fall. And he's really the first son that I've ever known to in that relationship. Sadly, my older sons, their mother and I were separated so that when this moment came in their lives, I was sadly not there, which is a, felt in all ways unhappy. So Will was the first specific son to go off to the world, et cetera, et cetera. So it was his birthday, I remember. This would be his 16th birthday or 17th. This is just at the time when he's about to do that. And in the opening, as I think this is right, the opening pages of Gertrude Stein's The Making of Americans, I think, begins with this anecdote that's certainly well previous to The Making of Americans, I mean, both to book and fact. But the first time I remember it is from Zhukovsky. It seems to me that he uses this in A, like Aristotle had a son named Nicomachus. Nicomachus had a son named Aristotle. That's the situation. As we come into this moment, it's that. You can forget it instantly. So-and-so had a son named so-and-so. For Will, I was at the door, still standing as if waiting for more, but not knowing what for. Was I with you? Already we'd come a long distance together. It was time now for something other. In my head, a story echoed. Someone had told me of how a son and father came to a like doorway. Then, in seeming anger, the son dragged the father out through an orchard until the father shouted, "Only this far, I drag my father, no more, put me down." Was this to be their parting, the last word? Was it only to be gone, each could think of then as each other? All their time together, silent, warm, knowing without thinking one another's mind. No end to such could there be? No, there was no end to it. Always life was the constant, and one held it, gave it, one to another, saw it go in that instant, with love, with all that one had known. No riddle to that, except there is no end either until it comes. No friends but those one finds. Not too long ago, I was visiting Philadelphia, and old friend Bob Perelman was remarking that for years I had determinedly, not so much resisted, but tried to find alternate ways of keeping a rhythm or a coherence, sounds, played off apposite or dissonant or dissonant kinds of location, half rhymes, and then he says, as though now. What I've been doing is trying curiously to get just to the other side, just to the opposite. it's to me, it's become almost exotic to use Mary had a little lamb, its fleece was white as snow, and everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go. That kind of simple go, snow, ho, 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 that rhyming I find absolutely delicious. I might begin thinking of Will. He's been much involved with various possibilities of music, but very kind of hands-on, not with any remarkable particular... He had training or lessons, but he moved quite particularly from saxophone to guitar to drums, and then he began to be more and more involved with mixing, with recording mixing, and then it finally moved very particularly to DJ, to that whole situation. And so he's a terrific information of what's happening. I was telling again friends that he, thinking of the virtues of the net, he'd located one of his pleasures, his friends, his interests in that rap, hip-hop. A very interesting young woman performer called Princess Superstar. She just has a new CD out. And so he wrote her this charming note of respect and interest in appropriate form. And he asked if he might work for her. And I mean, he said the phone rang within an hour. And he's worked probably at this very moment. He's working away there. I've heard her first on an equally interesting CD called This Is Very Stimulating by MC Paul Barman, Barman. That's a very challenging production. It's extremely funny, and it's very very not just hip. It's very deft. He's certainly the only white bisexual from New Jersey who's making a name for himself in rap. And he's got absolute, in the New York area, he's really on. Also, he has a degree from Brown, which is even more interesting in that way. And he's an incredibly deft and very, 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 very good. And he practices such a kind of sexual in-your-facism that's just... I don't know. It's very, very interesting. You might. I want to babble on a bit about these things because I'm interested in them. For example, I saw recently proofs of an anthology. I think it's called something like Heights of the Marvelous. It's edited by a younger poet named Todd Colby, and it has a whole cluster of younger contemporary poets in the New York area. Nothing so extraordinary about that, and some very dear people one would expect to find is Anselm Berrigan. But the difference is that there's no attempt to make them a further wave of... I mean, it was the first anthology, the first collection of this character, of this fact of younger writers, wherein the whole disposition humanly was very clearly coming from a place that was not so much contesting of mine, but just literally different. I remember years ago an old friend said to me in New York, he said, you know, nature is other people. It's not trees and flowers, it's literally other people or nature, and you study them. And this was the first writing that I had got that really took physically other people as there and had their presence, so to speak, not descriptively but functionally in the poems, that close, that intimate, and that fully scaled. Odors, sounds... look, everything is somehow not detailed, but is always imminent or actual. And I found that fascinating. And in this particular rap artist, that's very true. It's not just thinking things or what not to do in Boston. It's much quicker and much more substantiating. And I much recommend him to you. You can get it through Amazon.com. Just tell them you want it, and it'll be on its way. Sure, Paul will thank you too, right? I moved back then through the years let's see, this is Chael's out of schools, but he couldn't be here today. Kitai, he says, oh God. Just read Life and Death second time. Thanks so much for sending it. Wow, old age style, saith Lord K. Clark in a famous lecture on same and Goldie and oldie painters. You're there too, quote, age, unquote, indeed. Ain't we falling apart, though? I am, anyway, going next hour to UCLA hospital, two streets away, exclamation point, et cetera, et cetera. Great to meet Aunt Bernice again twice, so long after our huge day book. But above all, to read you anyhow. I just want to make clear that I'm not the only one that is concerned with age. So I figure if I read this long one, we'll be pretty much, we can go to bed. I'm sure everyone will have had enough for one day. Histoire de Florida. You're there, still behind the mirror, brother face. Only yesterday you were younger. Now you look old. Come out while there's still time left to play. Waking, think of sun through compacted tree branches, the dense, persistent light. Think of heaven, home, a heart of gold, old song of friends, dear love, and all the faint world it reaches to, it wants. Out over that piece of water where the sound is, the place it loops round on the map from the frontal ocean and makes a spit of land this sits on, here, flat, filled with a patent detritus left from times previous, whatever else was here before, become now brushy conclave, thick with hidden birds, nimble, small lizards. Whatever, whatever, wherever, whatever, whenever, it won't be here anymore. What one supposes dead is, but what a simple ending, pain, fear, unendurable, wrenched division, breakdown of presumed function, trucks broken, down again, no one left to think of it, fix it, walk on. Will one fly away on angel wings, rise like a feather, lift in the thin air, but again returned, preoccupied, he counts his life like cash in emptying pockets. Somebody better help him. Remember German artist, surely conceptual or happenings, ate himself, cut bits from his body on stage while audience watched. It went well for a while. But then he did something wrong and bled to death. The art is long to learn, life short. It must be anecdotal, sudden sights along the so-called way, Bunting's advice that David Jones, when he first met him, had moved but once in adult life, and then only when the building burned down, to a place across the street. They were having tea when abruptly Jones got up, went to an easel at the far end of the room, where on a sheet of drawing paper, with, in his immaculate script, a T, added an H to say, I'll have the E by Monday. Affections flood me. Love lights light in like eyes. Your two eyes will me suddenly slay. Such echoes of heaven on earth in mind as if such a glass through which, seen darkly, such reflected truth. What words then, if you love me, what beauty not to be sustained will separate finally dancer from dance. Sun, meantime, shining just now, now a yellow slid oblong patch light from wide window. But don't get physical with me, Topper or the Cheshire cat whose head could appear grinning in the tree, could appear in the window, could see in the dark. You still think death is a subject or a place in time, like halving the distance, the arrow that never gets there. I died and came back again to the very spot I'd seemingly left from in a Raj-like hotel, Calcutta, 1944. From lunch of prawns, got up and went to my room. An hour later, dimly recall, was on hands and knees, crawling to quantum toilet to vomit and shit, then must have collapsed completely en route back to the bed. And a long time later, heard voice, hotel doctors, they told me, saying, must get him to hospital. He can't die here. but I'd gone away down long, faint space of path, or up, or simply out, was moving away into a reassuring distance of somewhere. Heaven? I don't think so. My temperature was 96, etc., daily, or whatever, wherever had come to, gone to. I wasn't there. Leary at Naropa for celebration of Kerouac, I remember saying, it's dumb to die. It's for squares. Gregory thought it a dumb thing to say to the young. Was it metaphysical? Did he mean something else, whether with drugs or not, be rid of such terminal dependence? As if, and why not, closure were just fact of a clogged pipe, all coming to naught, get it out, open up. But the syntax would be what precedes and what follows, in Pound's phrase, like a river, the emptying sounds of paradise. In pajamas still, late morning sun's at my back, again through the window, figuring mind still, figuring place I am in, which is me, solipsistic, a loop yet moving, moving, with these insistent proposals of who, where, when, what's out there, what's in, what's the so-called art of anything, hat, house, hand, head, heart, and so on, quickly banal, always reflections, no light on the water, no clouds lifting, birds flap, taking off. Put the food in mouth, feel throat swallowing. Warmth is enough. Emotions recollected in tranquility, which is what? Feelings now are not quiet. Daughters threatened, kidneys, sisters' metal knee replacement, sons' vulnerable neighborhood friendships, Penelope's social suitors whom I envy, envy. Age, age. Locked in my mind, my body, toes broken, skin wrinkling up, look to the ceiling where, through portals of skylight, two rectangular glass boxes in the stained wood, the yellow light comes and outside is evident. There is no irony, no patience. There is nothing to wait for that isn't here, and it will happen. Happiness is thus lucky, not I, but the wind that blows through me. Another day, drove to beach, parked the car on the edge of the road, and walked up on the wooden ramp provided, then stopped just before the steps down to the sand, and looked out at the long edge of the surf, the sun glitter, the backdrop of various condominiums and cottages, the usual collective of people, cars, dogs, and birds. It was sweet to see company, and I was included. Yet Crusoe, whose mind was that? Defoe's, like Kafka's America, or Tom Jones come to London, or Rousseau, or Odysseus. One practices survival, much as we did when kids and would head for the woods with whatever we could pilfer or elders gave us, donuts, cookies, bread. Even in one's own terror, one is proud of a securing skill. But what so turned things to pain? And if Mandelstam's poem is found scratched on cell wall in the gulag by anonymous hand, and that's all of either we know, why isn't that instance of the same side of world Robinson Crusoe comes to? Footprint on sand, a terror. Person finally discovered an adversary he calls Friday, who then he learns to be good. But I wouldn't, I can't now know a resolve when it all became so singular, when first that other door closed and the beach and the sunlight faded, surf sounds grew faint and one's thoughts took over, bringing one home. At a dinner in Kuala Lumpur, where I was the guest, together with a sewage expert, had most recently worked in Saudi Arabia, where drainage was the problem, and here it was the same. We talked of conveniences, shopping malls, suburbs, and what had been hauled over from stateside habit, the bars and people, while just down the street was what the Kuala Lumpurians called the backside of hell, a short alley of small doorways and open stalls. They said here anything was possible. Meantime, in our hotel lobby, they had dyed some chicks a weird bluish pink and put them in a little cage out front for Easter. It's always one world, if you can get there. Histoire de Florida. Old persons swinging their canted metal detectors. Beaches either end out of sight beyond the cement block high-rises. occasional cars drifting by in the lanes provided, sheer banks of the dunes bulk headed by bulldozers. There, a few cars backed up, parked. People walk by or stretch out on cots, turning in the sun's heat, tanning. The line of the surf at some distance, small. The white edge of breakers where the surfers cluster. On the far horizon, east is bulk of a freighter. To the north, tower of a lighthouse across the inlet. Back of it, all the town sells. The early tourists, the stores filling with elderly consumers, the old are gathering for an old-time ritual. One knows that in the waters hereabouts, in a particular spring, Ponce de Leon staggered in so as to live forever, but poisoned with infection from a local's arrow and conned by the legend of eternal youth, he'd led all his people into a bloody cul-de-sac and ended himself being fed to alligators, ate him skin and bones, leaving no trace. So it may be we all now look for where the first of these old folks went down, seeing his own face in the placid creek, hearing the far-off murmur of the surf, feeling his body open in the dark, the warmth of the air, the odor of the flowers, the eternal maiden waiting soft in her bower. This is the lovely time of late afternoon when the sun comes in through slatted blinds. The large glass panes show streaks in the dust. Bushy laurels, green leaves, turn golden beyond. I hear plane pass over high in the sky, see flowers and vase tremble with tables movement. Companies become rooms quiet hum. This hanging silence fills with sound. Determined reading keeps the mind's attention off other things, fills the hole in symbolic stocking. Now that Xmas approaches, a truck through for proverbial night, the buzzes, roars of silence I hear here, all alone. Poor wee Robbie, flickering light in small window, meager head and heart in hand. I recall William Bartram somewhere in 18th century Florida, on night not unlike this one, after he'd hauled his skiff up on shore, then laid down, so he wrote, to sleep when sudden uproar, thumpings, bangings, poundings, all seeming very close, awakened him to possibility he was going to die. But stalwart, checked it out to find an alligator had clambered up and over the gunwales of his boat to get dead fish Bartram had left inside. And all was finally well. He drew great pictures of the natives, looking like quaint 18th century English persons in beguiling states of undress. He had a heart I wish I had. My car is parked in the driveway. My door is locked. I do not want to go outside. What was resistance? How come to this? Wasn't body's package obvious limit? Could I fly? Could I settle? Could I even be I? And for what want watching man die on TV in Holland, wife sitting by? She said he's going off alone for the first time in our lives. He told her, to the stars, to the Milky Way, relaxed, and was gone. What is Florida to me or me to Florida, except so defined? You've left a lot out. Being in doubt, you left it out. Your mother, Aunt Bernice, your son, your friend, John, you've left them out. You thought you were writing about what you felt. You've left it out. Your love, your life, your home, your wife, you've left her out. No one is one, no one's alone, no world's that small, no life. You left it out. The shell was the apparent inclusion that another might be here, form, the provision, what one took or didn't from another. What form did it take? What way did it matter? My mind was a supermarket or a fading neighborhood store. I couldn't find anything anymore or just didn't have it. I is another and another, another. Blocks fading, streets fading into an emptying distance. Who tore it down? Where was it? What was it? Where do you think you left it? My mother in Nokomis, Aunt Bernice in Nokomis, David in Sarasota, Mary Ann, Cecilia, Rebecca in Sarasota, John in Sarasota or Long Island, Penn, Will and Hannah, Helen in Buffalo. I use them simply as low-key points of reference who made me substance. Sarah calls to say she is pregnant, and that is a delicious sound, like the music Caliban hears, sometimes in Prospero's cell, surrounding him. Rise into the air and look down and see it there, the pendant form of it, the way it goes out alone into an ocean, the end of a pattern suddenly extended to cover in itself the western reach, the gulf close beyond. Its fragile surfaces are watery, swamps to the south, to the north where its population gathers in flat cities, sandy wastes, oaks, palmetto, laurel, pine, and, for me, an unidentified particularity, more seen, felt, than known. Perhaps the whole place is a giant peer out into nothing, or into all that is other, all else. Miles and miles of space are here in unexpected senses, sky washed with clouds, changing light, long sunsets, sinking across water and land, air that freshens, intimate, endless things growing, all horizontal, an edge, a rise only of feet above the sea's surface or the lakes, the ponds, the rivers, all out, nothing that isn't vulnerable, no depths, no rooted senses other than the actual fabric of roots, skin of survivals. I placed a jar in Tennessee. In Florida, I placed a jar. And round it was, upon a hill, and all around it grew important air, and tall and of a port and air. It was my first time there. It took dominion everywhere. And I was far from home and scared. The jar was gray and bare. In Florida, like nothing else in Tennessee. In Florida, like nothing else. Okay. Thank you. Should we have some questions, or get to it? It's a long. That's too long. Ha ha. Should stick with short poems. They're easier. Well. Lug.
You get to stretch and squirm. It's settled. It's amazing, some of the poems that you read, I read your autobiography recently in Tom Clark's book, which is so lovely.
I love that book, yeah.
And it's amazing how some of the events from your childhood, they're so informing, one of which I have that image, especially when you were talking about seeing Will off of your own father and the objects that he left behind, looking at his doctor's bag and that whole sense you wrote about traveling light. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Having Will, this particular dear person now, just at this fact of his life, this has nothing to do. I mean, I still don't know what I'm going to do when I grow up, and I don't think I ever will. I think it's getting a little late to figure it out, which reminds me of a beautiful story Franz Klein told of Franz Klein was that his mother, long after he had, quote, made it, and had bought this terrific house in Provincetown, where on the great carpenter, whose name was Tom Sawyer, where until both men realized there was literally nothing more to be done. And anyhow, apparently Klein's mother was visiting him, and they're walking along, Commercial Street in Provincetown, and they go by a furniture, an antique furniture retort thing, and she looks at it and says, Franz, it still isn't too late. And I don't think my mother wouldn't say something like that to me. She said things like, if I'd known you were feeling so bad, I would have tried to have helped you. I was at least rather more sympathetic. But I was honored, not honored in some sense of like receiving an award, but I was honored by the, I had never had a father in any memory that I can discover. I didn't feel like a fatherless child particularly because of the hierarchy. In fact, my father was so clear in the pattern of our household, and all of the persons who had known him, my sister, mother, etc., all of them left there was such an impression upon them that I lived in that relationship. But I had no locating memory of a father, except a very faint, almost subliminal. So, I mean, I've been, it was the best of scenes, it was the worst of scenes. I think I've been a father in almost every dimension you can have. That is hopeless, terrific, you know, whatever. But I've had remarkably terrific children in all states of reality and mind and character. The one bond that curiously is held is the father. Not in some hierarchic sense, but some curious emotional ground.
I guess I kept thinking of that image of the doctor's bag, and we're talking about kind of giving you a sense that words that you could carry in your head and they're free. I mean, in a sense, being a poet, you don't have to carry. I mean, you do carry a small laptop around now, but you do travel light.
It seemed to me the one limit. I mean, always with other aspects of the arts, with the real exception of music. I mean, the point being that one can carry music in some ways, but still there's usually a physical object that's used to produce it, unless you sing, which at that point it's conjoined with poetry in ways I would, well, you know. I mean, I carry all this paraphernalia with me because I can't remember, you know. But if I set, quote, my mind, unquote, to it, I could obviously do it. I would learn to. The thing is that I love the economy of poetry. It was absolutely fitting for a kid growing up in New England. A penny saved is a penny earned, a waste not, want not. All poetry, the fact that it was so, you know, cheap, the cheapest of the arts, poetry. Yeah.
Well, you have some wonderful writing about the whole idea of the commonplace, and in America, you said that the base of the language is an extraordinary commonplace language, endlessly comes back to cliches, idioms, banality, triteness, triviality, because frankly, that is the most valuable conduit for information that we possess. And I loved your image of the language flowing through this, sort of like this manic plumber.
Yeah.
That you say what you have, you know, that how to get said what must be said.
That's Williams.
Right,
that's
right.
True. But there's I think of these terrific rap groups. Common is the name of a really active group at the moment, and probably for some time to come. It isn't trying to be talk like some imagination of the common speech. It's just tell it like it is. There are masters of it who if one were to try to discuss with them this kind of concern would probably just forget it, but there are people who have that extraordinary gift of a cadence and a vocabulary that feels utterly at home. Kerouac has that, for example. Alan has that for me. I mean, others. That's what I was always displaced by, was a cadence or a way of saying things that jarred upon that sense of their familiarity. I wanted it to be. I wanted it to move with a completely easy and. I just didn't want to have to think about the way things were. I wanted to say what you have to say. I don't want to have to worry about the way you're saying it.
Well, for those here who, I mean, we mentioned projective verse in the program notes, and that whole sense of it coming out of the breath. If you could kind of just give a long lecture on Olson and projective verse, but just the basic ideas that informed that movement in poetry.
Well, we were looking for some alternative to the sort of intellectual basis that most of the poetry around us then had. The classic text of that imagination of poetry is Understanding Poetry, the very title of which gives a clear key to the premise. It wasn't stupid, but it did seemingly depend upon intellectual recognitions and locations.
Well, with Eliot, you needed footnotes.
Yeah, well, that's okay. I mean, footnotes are, sometimes the footnotes are better than the text. and, you know, it was the great, my little Brooks Adams writes a terrific preface to The Emancipation of Massachusetts, which is longer than the text, which I always thought was wonderful. So, I mean, it isn't, you know, I wouldn't, if Eliot's footnotes had only been longer, more. I mean, he's only getting started. And he only wrote them, apparently, according to the, you know, the rumor that to fill out the book, to make it a little more substantial. That they weren't primarily his interests. They were the publisher's means of making the book seem more solid. But getting, it's hard, breath, looking for, again, for some agency of measure or of cadence or of locating how it was that things took place in time. And Ezra Pound says that poetry is a shape cut in time, as is music. It's not, I remember Stevens's objection to, he said there are those who speak as a form as though it were, in poetry as though it were derivative of plastic shape. It's not. It's a time art. At least the poetry that I've practiced, no contradiction with other poetries that one concrete or whatever, but the poetry I've been involved with is a form cut in time. So again, music, interval, pace, cadence, sound, tone, all of these factors are very critical. And breath is what gives them reality.
You've also likened, you know, you were talking about silences in poetry as well, and you feel an affinity with the other time art, with jazz, especially. That's why I had Charlie Parker playing when we came in, and I was trying to listen to it the other day, and just to hear those silences in the music. You've had friendships then with jazz musicians, or they were informing to your
some great ones. Most friend that think of Lewis and Phoebe here. Remember from Bellinas days, Steve Swallow, who happily told me charmingly that his daughter became hooked on horses forever because our daughter Sarah who's in the poem, had been their babysitter and had a horse, and Steve's daughter became hooked, who now has a great stable of horses and seems to be entirely occupied with them. But the thing is, again, when I was first setting out, as they say, as a poet, or trying to be a poet, whatever a poet was, the company that would be most receptive to what I was doing was almost without exception musicians. Musicians could hear the patterns. I remember one wonderful time at Black Mountain. One friend, it was Mike Roemaker, had just read a story, and another friend, Don Cooper, his name was, I think, was a musician, and he was studying with Volpe. He simply tapped out on the table all the rhythmic patterns of the story. Mm. Well, you know, when people talk about what does the story mean, I'll say, well, wait a minute, just play back for me what you heard. Just play it as a rhythm. What was that? Like in that last poem I read, just everybody, all together now, let's tap it out. See, it has that dimension or that physical condition, and that's very that's very relevant to how it affects people. I don't make a design of it. I mean, I don't have a plan. But that ability to keep things moving.
Keep it moving.
Clark Coolidge has a charming book, Now It's Jazz, that's been published within the last year. And in it, he includes a terrific article he'd written on particular senses of drumming. And he says, Elvin Jones makes a great point that you can get into, you can find the door to get in, but it's finding the door to get out that's difficult.
Oh, that takes me in a bunch of different directions, but staying on Black Mountain for a moment, that formative time when there were this interdisciplinary school where there were within the same kind of cauldron dancers, musicians, painters, I guess the closest I've ever come to experiencing that was Naropa, somewhat in the 70s. Do you think there's any place like Black Mountain that still exists that in today's education?
Not that I know of. Not that Black Mountain was a pinnacle, but I think Hugh Kenner some years ago, talking of Black Mountain, proposed it was in the. It was one of the classic American utopian enterprises, Brook Farm, whatever. It was Brooks Farm. It was an imagination of the possibility of of a articulate, self-sustaining, self-instructing, self-providing community. And that's a very familiar business in American. And there are variants. There are more or lesses of it in several places I can think of. But the I think the times are approaching the right, you know, context. Remember that the 50s, there was never a time more hostile that I was aware of to experimental education than that particular decade. The lonely crowd, the man in the gray flannel suit, Eisenhower's president, the McCarthy's begins it. Anyhow, it was not a time when people really wanted to talk about either art or anything which was not right according to plan. So paradoxically, that goes along with Klein's remark that, you know, Bohemians are people who can live where animals would die. But then you could read it, then you could go quickly to a new book, which has just been published called Bobos in Paradise, which is bourgeois Bohemians.
Right, right. I just read
so,
about that.
So much for Bohemia. It's become a...
But the vigor of that post-war art scene, in one of the essays of yours I was reading, you were talking about this kind of wonderful incident with Philip Guston and him inviting you to his studio. And you were also saying how Guston and Klein and de Kooning, they were all readers. I mean, there was a sense of them reading the poets as you were interested in looking at the work. And that seems like a very enviable kind of condition of...
I'm sure that the same, that continues. I don't have the least doubt that that must continue, that company and exchange must somewhere be obviously happening. But again, just to say in the university where I teach, the dispositions almost of its necessity has gone more and more to cost effective, to the structuring of education, social conditions of education more and more overwritten, not hostily, but hey, we've got to keep this place going. It's impractical to try to, you know, keep a university open if you can't make sufficient monies to let it be. On and on and on. So that the whole body politic seems completely confused as to what constitutes its social responsibilities and its economic responsibilities for the world in which it lives, you know. And insofar as we have nothing left now but humans decisively in charge of that possibility, it's pretty spooky. Yeah.
I was noticing all the references in the poems, the recent poems to you wrote about that really refer to history or world events. I was thinking of that Seamus Heaney had said about the power of poetry that no lyric has ever stopped a tank, but that on the other hand, the impact of it can be unlimited. And I wonder what you thought is the power of poetry.
Well, perhaps if the tank driver was a poet, he wouldn't be driving the tank. I mean, I've just reading a book and thinking of books. I'm reading a beautiful book just on the way out here, Anne Leal's Ghost. It's a new novel of Michael Ondaatje's, poet indeed. And on page 119, the person of the book at that moment is the recollections of the situation of this hospital for the victims of the wars. And very quietly and specifically, that one comes to the sentence that I will no longer tolerate in any sense anyone who stands up for war. That there is just no, whether for property, for personals, state rights, wrongs, all wars define the same person, and all wars are abhorrent, you know. And I say, yes, but what about so and so? You know, there's no longer any excuse for war except the human commitment to it as an agency. So, you think, well, now how can you say that? Hey, man, I'm driving this tank. You know, what am I going to do with it now? Take it home, or what? You know, it's heavy. You know, so. What's left is opportunity. If I can't drive this tanker, you know, come on. But I remember I saw recently in like sense our cluster, or the cluster of our U.S. senators who had been in Vietnam,
right.
And you know, they're quite an interesting range of people, quite different some of them. And they're being questioned by some, you know, actually quite genial, usual person. And they were being asked what did they, What had happened to them? What was the most significant thing that had happened to them in this experience? What had happened to them? Well, I was really struck, and they talked on for, you know, a good, it was Tom Lehrer was talking to them. Not one of them mentioned peace. The word peace didn't enter into this discussion once. Not once. I said, you know, you think that six people who have been in the war might have some questions about, A, why they were there, or B, even one did. One came back to protest quite distinctly. One of them, all of them said in a curiously perverse manner that they really thought it made them better people, that it brought them closer together, it made them recognize others in ways they hadn't been able to before. I mean, it was almost, it sounded like some mad irony, you know. First time I was shot at, I realized there was really someone out there. I had never realized that other people existed until someone tried to kill me, or else I tried to kill them. That's, I can't believe those people in the United States Senate.
I don't know if you saw that.
Don't vote for them, folks. Who knows what's next?
The documentary, I don't know if you had a chance to see it, called Regret to Inform, which is about widows of men who died in Vietnam. And what was interesting to me was that some of these widows who had suffered, obviously, you know, this great loss, at the same time could say, but I really question what he was doing there. And I think to be able to both be affected by the loss and then be able to go the one step further and say, but why was he there?
That's a good question.
It's a big leap. And I wondered if your own experience in Burma has come back to you more as you are aging. I mean, is it something that you think about more?
I thought, you know, it's like, who was that masked rider? I feel it was like Apocalypse Now. I couldn't then, nor can I now. I can understand rationally, quote unquote, why it seems to have happened. But in the larger view, as one says, it was absolutely, think of it, what had brought these extraordinarily diverse national groups? I mean, what had brought someone from Boston, Massachusetts to, you know, Rangoon, you know, that's not a casual distance. I was driving an ambulance in the British 14th Army.
Why the British Army?
Well, I was a volunteer. I was 4F. I wanted to take part in this great enterprise, and I would never do that again. I also married at 20. Two acts I don't regret for the fact that they occurred, but I certainly would advise others to think twice before you marry at 20 or volunteer to go off to war. You know.
This is being recorded. So.
Please. I'll sign anything. You know. But truly, I thought it was like some awful black humor. Because the population specific, again, this novel, Enlil's Ghost, gives a sense of the displacement of a population during these times of contest. And just so the Burmese culture and persons itself was being absolutely just absolutely trashed. I mean, even to this day, the effects of that trashing are the case. I mean, he's almost 50 years later, and Burma has never been the same since that awful time. Hmm. And also remember that these people in that situation, the British Army was there. They had a 4.5-year length of service, and they were referred to as the Forgotten Army. I mean, people almost forgot that they were there. I mean, they, you know, people got lost, displaced. There always was a tattered cluster of up to 15 people whose basic unit had been mustered out, but their term of service was not yet done, so they hadn't been reassigned. They just hang out until they could get home. It was not. There was no leaves to go home. It was a long way from Burma to England. Hmm. And then I remember people said, "You've got to be very careful. These people come back like mad beasts. You know, you have to quarantine them and make sure they don't attack the other people."
Duncan writes of this phrase of where the heart finds rest. I think he defined that place where you're open and that. So there's a sense of defensiveness and other complexes of response to place can be finally dropped. Do you feel like you have that now?
Again, in this great quotation, I should have brought the book with me. But he speaks of the in the hospital situation. this doctor gets so exhausted operating, and I remember I worked in that, so where a doctor operated without seats for 72 hours straight.
This is in the...
This is in Burma. This is in the novel, the same situation. And he goes into this room, the children's ward, where there's the presence of the mothers. All the mothers are there, not the fathers, because they're probably either fighting or dead. But all the mothers are there, and even though the children may be comatose, the mothers are holding them when there's a hand on them. And he said in that great insistent sexuality of that touch, that that wish that these children feel secure, that they have a life that can continue, which is a sexual touch, really. It's not, you know, it's not dirty or anything. It's a bond of that sexual fact, flesh of my flesh. That's what it's all about. So that, he said, he feels very, very. That's and then comes the remark: I will never have to do with anyone who stands up for war ever again. And he hears the men screaming. I mean, I remember witnessing one man. I used to carry these dear people, you know, the holes all through them, and arms gone. You know, I used to get out of this ambulance every morning, and they put the stretchers of those who had died in the night out beside my ambulance, like the parking lot, and so they could be picked up and taken off for burial. So every morning there'd be somebody new and stuff. Well, you know, better things to do at 18. And that was the good side, you know. I mean, I didn't have the awful onus of trying to figure out why I was killing people.
And then when you came back, that's when you went to Black Mountain? I mean, that was the,
I'd gone to Black Mountain. I came 10 years later. This is 1945. I'm coming back. See, again, just to not, but why give that question to an 18-year-old, or even to a, that's an awful person. Why have a need to kill? Why have to kill? I don't know.
When you were there, did you in your mind, were you already the poet gathering?
No. Heavens, no. I had poetry with me.
What did you take with you?
Yeats's last poems, those late poems, Crazy Jane and all that. And I had a war anthology, which had Alan Lewis, I remember, and both British and American, on the fury of aerial bombardment by Richard A. Barhart, et cetera. And poets who have been long sadly forgotten, like Timothy Chrysalis. But I had that. I had Pound's A Draft of 30 Cantos. Hmm. It was, again, what I was, as a young man, was, I thought, here's, you know, all of our human life to this moment has thought of what way in which, how it might live, you know, how it might create a system of inclusion for all that humanness is, and this is, here we are, Second World War, not looking good at all, you know, it's as though nothing had really moved an inch. And that was disappointing. You say, well, certain agencies of physical of recognition of physical phenomena, but the condition of human life is certainly not very pleasant. I mean, out on the freeway today, yesterday, I don't think that's very pleasant either.
No.
I can't believe it.
Well, we tend to get very provincial here. We stay in our neighborhoods a lot.
Well, that was being said to me by an old friend. Who lives back and forth between here. We were just talking earlier today, and she was saying that it's possible in Los Angeles to really live all one's life and not have much to do with the neighborhood other than that one. Whereas we were talking about the contrast with New York, well, that would be harder. You could not live in New York without being aware, you know,
right,
of X, Y, or Z as being
right
there.
Although people here are brought together, I mean, just going to the library can be a place where you meet all kinds of different people. I mean, it's inevitable. It's a city where people are brushing up against each other in unexpected ways.
But Westwood, they didn't seem to be doing much.
They weren't doing much brushing.
I see. Maybe three or four blocks
Wilshire. Okay. No. What advice would you give to young writers today, someone who wanted to be a poet?
Go for it, I guess. I'm
sure you get asked this a lot.
The one that stays most, I mean, it's obviously it's like go play in some old-fashioned sense, perhaps, but it seems still true that, quote, be true to the dreams of thy youth, unquote, that Olson told me Melville had his motto over his writing table. That sense of the only despairs I feel in the determination to have a career in writing is some particular plan or procedure that will get one to the desired goal. It's just, it seems to me in all ways too destructive, too set up for. I think I really would believe more, don't do it if you don't feel really drawn to do it or compelled to do it or have to do it, because otherwise it's not a, it can be a terrific and be fun, as you generously quoted, but it can also be frustrating, despairing. And it, if you don't like doing it, don't, because it's, it is its own reward, like life itself. You know?
You want to take a few, would you want to take
a few please,
questions?
Please.
Questions? This gentleman here? Do you share some of your memories of your last conversation with Charles Olson?
He had not, he had sadly finally come into hospital. Harvey Brown was his old friend, younger friend, but old, very particular friend of his life. Asked him, Harvey told me, whether I should be told that Charles was now in this terminal sad state. And Charles characteristically said, oh, he'll find his own way here. Thanks a lot. And so I was not, you know, I was not told that he was this ill until maybe a week before he, in fact, dies. And therefore, only got to the hospital within that time. Duncan then came from California very shortly after. And the, I remember I got down to the city the night before. It was too late to visit, so I'd spent the night at Jerry Malanga's place. And Jerry Malanga had done that incredible interview with Charles, so I needed company in an old-fashioned sense. And so he came with me. And when I got there, I asked Charles, "Would mind if Jerry came in?" He said, "No, no." He really was very pleased and thought that that interview had been a lot of fun. And so to me, he said specifically, the fundament stays as put as the firmament. In other words, your life is physical event on physical earth, and your bottom literally is a condition that should never be forgotten, that one sort of thinks to the stars or feels one's managed that scale or possibility, but the finiteness and fundamentalness of one's life should never be overlooked or forgotten. So I remember that particularly. He was still bemused. He still was thinking that there might be. He was fascinated by that liver. If you could live her, if you could somehow open that phrase into some information. He was looking forward to the visit of the neurologist. He said one of his frustrations was that the medical staff attending thought that his conversation was aberrant they couldn't really understand what he was talking about, so they presumed it was some fact of his physical illness.
What a pity.
Well, yeah.
There's another question? Mark?
You mentioned that when you looked around in World War II, the situation didn't look so good. How does the situation look to you now?
How does the situation look to you now, in short?
Not good. Not good in the sense that the... for all the obvious reasons that the disparity, I was still hearing recently the statistics vis-a-vis the inroads or the deaths that AIDS has caused in Africa. What I'm really, again, along with the quantifying of that's being practiced in New York State vis-a-vis the state university system, it isn't that it's wrong. It's a very practical way of quantifying or programming in one way sense what it is one has as you know what one's doing and how much one's paying for it. But Having said that, then comes the question, how much, what does one need, and what is one therefore not only willing to pay for, but feels is necessary to pay for? I think one thing that curiously spooked me a few days ago had nothing to do with the person, but it was in an orals defense, you know, committee where the student's being asked questions about his or her particular study, and this person had a dual concentration in philosophy and literature. So I asked quite innocently, really, what truths did he believe? I thought of, you know, the Constitution, we hold these truths to be self-evident. And it goes on that all men are created equal, not women, mind you. Anyhow, I wasn't really interested in what Jefferson said or whomever said it. But I was interested in what truths would this person that I was now talking to presume to be self-evident? Were there any truths that anyone presumed to be self-evident? That is, was there anything in the human world that one could depend upon as being a given? The people, you know. And it was shocking to me. He said, gee, I really can't think of anything. I said, wow, that's pretty far out. I mean, isn't there any communal belief or sense or recognition you feel vis-a-vis the world we live in that you think is self-evident?
And none?
None? Well, I don't think he said, no, I can't think of anything. Well, it was a situation, obviously, that was fraught enough without such a vague question. But
Did he pass?
I wonder if we asked our company what truths we might propose as self-evident and what we would therefore think to conclude from them. For instance, I was in São Paulo, since I've seen you last, and there we know that, say, 12 million homeless kids, you know, are part of its population, second largest city human aggregation in the world. And we also know that without, even if you talk to pleasant, you know, good-natured people, they will say, gee, we don't know what to do. The federales, an echo from the dictatorship, we know that they do this, that is, that they round these kids up and exterminate them, like, you know, dogs or cats, and that's disappointing. I mean, that's not just irony, but that's what's happening. I mean, that's what I mean, that the one would hold a truth to be self-evident. You don't kill children.
Exactly.
But we do kill children, so that truth isn't self-evident, apparently, not sufficiently.
Not shared by all.
We don't, right to life, pursuit of happiness. We say we believe it, but we don't, in endlessly evident instances. So, you know, I could come here like a bleeding heart and go on and on and say, you know, what? I almost feel like I would go jump off the building so I can go to sleep. You know? But the point is, that's what's scary, that maybe it's a divide and conquer tactic, but I really loathe the aspects of our society that so emphasize competitive disposition and say, well, you know, only one person can win.
So did you find any hope in the protests against the WTO in Seattle? I mean, in the sense that there's kind of a growing awareness of...
Well, again, as this friend we were talking just before we came over, Ed was saying, seeing it from England, the reporting was much... When it got that same protest continues to New York, I'm not to Washington more accurately, there it's very... When one sees the violence with which these protesters are being dealt, smashed in the face, and one recognizes that seemingly, after all, in the capital of the damn United States, the fabled nation of the damned, in the capital of our country, this is accommodated conduct. And what I'm trying to say is that if it's possible to deal physically with people with that violence and without any response. And these people, I know because my son is at NYU, and he and friends were thinking very particularly of going down, mm-hmm, as were mm-hmm, many.
Mm-hmm.
This was, again, it had echoes of the 60s in a way.
Right, right.
And one saw, not this time, it's not going to be like that again, kid. You know? Yeah.
And as a poet, what gives you for yourself? The question is, what gifts on the day that Bob's son departed, did he see himself as having given to his son? Had he wished that he'd given to his son?
I didn't have any physical objects, or I know you don't mean that particularly. I remember, again, Charles Olson years ago saying the condition in which one's children leave the home is the best, is the only thing finally a parent can give them, is the way they feel about the world, the way they care about it, the way they move in it, the confidence, the response, the recognition. And I feel, yeah, I'm very proud of this person. I love him. I mean, I think now when I see him, one of the delights is that we embrace. We're very emotionally easy with each other, and that so far it would seem he's more interested in the world in which he lives than in wanting what he probably will at some point feel he must. I mean, he's more interested in the world than in taking something out of it, you know. That's all I would ever want him to be. You know?
That's a wonderful place to end. I want to thank you so much for being here today. Thank you for coming.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the law firm Arendt Fox. Media support provided by KPCC 89.3 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.